Can I just give a quick plug for the evening service? You know, in the evenings we have different styles of service. Sometimes they're talks and discussion, and we give a lot of time to that. Sometimes they're more prayer and sharing and times of waiting on God and listening to Him. And sometimes we call them celebration services, a bit of an old-fashioned term, but where we give more time to sung worship. And tonight's one of those nights, so if you want to come tonight and Dave told me what it's about, and I've completely forgotten. What's the theme, Dave? Inspired and excited by God. And the reason I want to mention this is because it's very much in keeping with, I think, the flow of our services today, and particularly of the passage that we have this morning. Now, last week, we had a dramatized reading, and we would have had another one this week, but poor Lola Chapman, her family have all got ill. She's ill, I think, so do say a prayer for them. So what I'll do is try to cover the sort of story as we go along. So we're thinking of Elijah on Mount Carmel. You familiar with that story a little bit? I hope you are. Elijah, the big showdown. Elijah and the prophets of Baal. So Elijah was a prophet in the 9th century BC. And he lived in that time when Israel was a divided nation. You remember that it was united under the kingship of Saul and then David and then Solomon. That was its golden era in many ways. But then after Solomon died and his sons took over, it split, and split really north and south. A lot of countries are split north and south, aren't they? But it split north and south. The north was the northern 10 tribes, 10 of the 12. And that, rather confusingly, was called Israel. And then the southern kingdom was called Judah, the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. And that was two tribes. But the significant thing to mention probably is that although Judah was two tribes, Jerusalem, the capital historically and the center of worship, was in Judah. And it was in many ways often more faithful to God than the north. At the time of Elijah, the king in the north at this point was King Ahab. And here's quite a helpful summary of the man that he was. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, son of Omri, became king of Israel. And he reigned in Samaria over Israel 22 years. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. He not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, but he also married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and began to serve Baal and worship him. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than did all of the kings of Israel before him. So Ahab was bad news. He turned people away from Yahweh, Jehovah, the true God, to the worship of Baal. And his evil was made worse by his choice of wife. He married Jezebel. You might say she was a little princess. Her father was the king of Tyre, and Jezebel was a follower of Asherah. Here we see statues, ancient statues of Asherah and of Baal. He's a funny looking god, I thought. A funny looking idol, but anyway. But Jezebel had 400 prophets of Asherah that she would personally sort of welcome and feed under her patronage, if you like, in the palace. So Israel's in a mess. It's turned to idolatry. It's an apostate nation. And as a result, they were experiencing drought. This was sent by God. It's a three and a half year drought, actually. And it's interesting because God was, if you bear with me, he was really hitting them where it hurts. And what I mean by that is they had turned to worship Baal. What was Baal's speciality supposed to be? Rain, weather. He was the storm god. He was the god who was the god who rode on the thunder clouds. So actually, they were worshipping a god of rain, but it hadn't rained for 3.5 years. This is really painful for them. And God is setting up a real showdown here between God and Baal. So this drought's been going on. It's got so bad that we read that Ahab sent out search parties just to look for grass to feed his livestock. because the animals are starting to die. That's how desperate the situation is. And one of these search parties was led by Obadiah. Now, Obadiah was a good guy. He was a devout follower of God. And it's Obadiah that came across Elijah. See, Ahab's been looking for Elijah for 3 years, but Elijah's evaded him. First of all, Elijah went to the east of the Jordan, to that deserty area, and he lived at the brook at Cherith. And then he went right up to the northern area, beyond Israel, up into Phoenicia, to Zarephath, as we heard last week. The territory of Baal, actually. And so Elijah's evaded Ahab's detection. We read that Obadiah says to Elijah, there isn't a country or nation where he hasn't sent people looking for you. But now Elijah, if you like, comes out into the open because the time has come when God is going to bring an end to this drought, but he's going to do it in such a way as to show the people, once and for all, who is God. Yeah? Who is God? And so, when Elijah met Ahab, it's funny, Elijah seems to give King Ahab all the instructions and the commands, but Elijah says to him, meet him on Mount Carmel, and he said, bring with you all the people of Israel, so it'd be a huge crowd there, and he said, bring with you 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah. So there's Carmel, it's right up in the northern part of Israel. Here's a cartoon I came across. Come one, come all. Elijah invites you, all prophets, to Baal, to a free barbecue. Mount Carmel this Friday. Don't miss it. It will be the hottest event this season. So that's what. But this is a confrontation that's been brewing for 3.5 years. And as I said, it's not just between Elijah and Ahab. It's between Yahweh, God, and the true and living God, and this false god Baal, this idol. Who are the people going to believe in? Just close your eyes for a moment and picture yourself on Mount Carmel, or on a mountain at least. And there's that solitary figure, Elijah. And there's King Ahab and the 450 prophets of Baal, 400 prophets of Asherah, all the people. When I picture it, as I did this week, the theme tune to Rocky came into my mind. You remember that one? I don't know if you can sense that or feel that music. But that's what it's about, isn't it? This is a serious conference. That's really twee, wasn't it? But just wanted to do it. But that is the kind of confrontation we're talking about. This is, it actually demeans it because it's a Hollywood moment. But this is an incredible moment in Israel's history, isn't it? And we read, once the people are there, first of all, Elijah challenges the people and he basically says, who are you going to follow? If God is God, follow him. If Baal is God, follow him. But just decide at least who you're going to follow. And then we read these words. Verse 22. Elijah said to them, I'm the only one of the Lord's prophets left. Now, actually, that wasn't true. There were other prophets, but they're in hiding in caves. And it is true that Elijah was the only one stood there, putting his neck on the line for God. Okay, so I'm the only one left. Baal has 450 prophets. Get two bowls for us. Let them choose one for themselves. And let them cut it into pieces and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. I will prepare the other bowl and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. Then you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord. The God who answers by fire, he is God. Then all the people said, what you say is good. I'm sure they did. This is better than TV, isn't it? This is a prophetic punch-up, an amazing sort of spectacle on Mount Carmel. But is it a fair fight? No, it's not. It's not a fair fight. You see, what Elijah does is he, to the people, as far as the people are concerned, he's put everything in the favor of Baal here. It's all in Baal's favor. Look at the location, Carmel. It's not in Jerusalem. It's not in the heart of the place of a center of worship. It's in Mount Carmel, right on the edge, practically into pagan territory. In fact, Carmel overlooks these days Haifa. It's right up there. He is alone with these 450 prophets around him. He chose the bull. Why is the bull significant? Well, because Baal was understood as a god to ride upon the bull. Okay? So he's chosen the very vehicle of Baal, the very animal that Baal should absolutely be drawn to as the animal of sacrifice. And he lets them choose the bull first. You know, their understanding in those days is that the gods wanted the best sacrifice, you know, so you don't bring a skanky animal to a god, you know. You bring the best you can find. And he says, well, you choose. You get the best one, and I'll get the one that's not so good. And Baal will surely be happy with that. But I think the biggest way in which he weights this in Baal's favor is he said, the proof will be in the God who answers by fire. Now, why is that significant? Because Baal was the god of storm and rain. What do you get in storms? Lightning. In fact, in those days, they called lightning bolts the arrows of Baal. So this should be dead easy for Baal to send a lightning bolt on this sacrifice. This is playing into Baal's hands, you might think. So it's not in Elijah's favor, but Elijah knows. He has the confidence of how this is going to go, because he knows Baal is not a real god. He's an idol. And he knows that the more he stacks the odds against the true and living God, the more spectacular the miracle is going to be when people see it. So the prophets of Baal prepare the sacrifice, the bull, the good one. And then they begin to pray. And it says they began to pray in the morning. Let's say it was about 9 o'clock. And they prayed until noon. They prayed and they danced around the altar for 3 hours, more or less. And at noon, Elijah began to taunt them. Never get on the wrong side of a prophet. Okay. In fact, what he says next, some people have said this is the best put down of someone else's faith in the whole of ancient Near Eastern literature. He taunts them. Maybe he taunts them at midday because that's the time when the sun is at its hottest and they have most chance of success. I don't know. But he says, shout louder. Surely he's a god. Perhaps he's in deep thought, or maybe he's busy. Maybe he's traveling. Some people believe that the Hebrew is saying maybe he's gone to the toilet and he's not back yet. He says maybe he's sleeping. Shout louder, wake him up. You know, you might think Elijah's been rude here, but I think it's well and good to remember he's not speaking here to people of a different nation. He's speaking to his own nation. And he's not speaking to people of a different religion. He's speaking to the people of the covenant who were supposed to be worshipping Yahweh, God. And so he's saying, well, what has your God done for you lately? How has he helped you? Where is he? Is he going to show himself? Is he going to send this fire or not? And so at his taunting, the prophets, we read, we're told in the verses, get frantic. And they begin mutilating themselves. I'm sure we've all seen pictures of worshippers in other countries at times cutting themselves. I've seen this until, well, they did it in 1 Kings 18. They cut themselves with spears and swords until their blood flowed, it says. I mean, if you're queasy, then don't picture this. But if you're not, you can picture 450 prophets of Baal bleeding in an attempt to get the attention of this so-called God. They were desperate. But after 6 hours, even they gave up. And what happens next is very significant. Elijah calls the people to him, the people of Israel, gather round, and there are three ways in which what he does is significant. The first one is we're told he repairs the altar. Now, there was an altar to God on Mount Carmel. It had fallen into disuse. It was in ruins because people hadn't been worshipping there. They'd been worshipping Baal. And he rebuilds it. That's a powerful symbol of saying, I am restoring true worship here. Worship of the true God. You're worshipping at the wrong altar. He is the right altar. Come and worship here. And then he takes 12 stones. Now, why is that significant, do you think? 12? 12 tribes. It represents the 12 tribes of Israel. The text tells us that. And what he's saying is, look, you 10 tribes in the north, you've broken away from the south. And you've broken away from the historic place of God in our life. But come back. Be reunited again with the southern two tribes. Join with the nation. In fact, we read also he takes 12 jars or jugs of water and pours them on the sacrifice. Again, we have that number 12 that speaks and reminds them of the 12 tribes. But I think the most significant thing about this is the time that Elijah sacrifices, which is 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, does anyone know why 3 o'clock in the afternoon might be important? That is when Jesus died. What else happened? That happened once. What happened every day in the temple at 3 o'clock? The afternoon sacrifice. The temple had an afternoon sacrifice in Jerusalem. That's 60 miles from Carmel, every day at 3 o'clock. Elijah at 3 o'clock is preparing and offering his sacrifice. Again, he is calling the 10 tribes back into unity with the southern tribes to come and worship God again, this prodigal nation. Well, that's all well and good, but the real test, of course, is what happens next, isn't it? We saw how Elijah deliberately stacked the odds against God, you could say. He makes it even worse. He takes these 12 jars of water and he tells them to douse the offering. It would have been absolutely saturated with water. He told them to dig a trench around the altar that we're told is big enough to hold 15 litres in modern terms, and that was full of water, so it's absolutely dripping wet. What chance might there be of success? But of course, we know it wasn't a fair contest at all, because God is the living God. Baal had no chance, did he, really? And with that confidence, Elijah prays. There's no dancing, there's no shouting, there's no self-mutilation. Just a simple prayer. A simple prayer that trusts in a powerful God. Because if God is real and if God has power, we don't have to jump up and down, do we? We don't have to cut ourselves to get his attention. He's there. And so we read 1 Kings 18:36. At the time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, O Lord, are God and that you are turning their hearts back again. Simple prayer. And then you know what happened next. The fire fell from heaven. The fire fell. It's not a lightning bolt. It's not one of the arrows of Baal. Because there are no clouds. We're told at the end of the chapter, Elijah has to pray for the clouds to come so that the rain might come. There's no clouds in the sky. It's not a fire that was started from below. It's a fire that came from above. And it is a supernatural fire. It's not just a fire that burnt up the sacrifice, even though it was soaking wet. But it also burnt up the wood and the stones and the soil and evaporated all the water in the trench. You know, this is a supernatural act of God, and the people recognized it. No more Baal is God, or maybe Baal's God, but they say the Lord, he is God. He approved it beyond doubt who the true God was. We sang that chorus. I don't know how Nikki found such an appropriate chorus. Nikki moved house yesterday, by the way. She's done very well to lead us this morning. But it was speaking about the people kneeling down at that sacrifice and saying, Lord, you are God. And then that chorus, you are good, and your love endures. And the people realized who God was. It's not the God of Baal who hasn't sent rain for 3.5 years. It is the God of Israel. Well, I want us to receive two challenges from this morning's passage. And they're both about faith, the kind of faith that we need to have. And there's a sense here of a faith that reaches up and a faith that expects God to reach down to us too. So the faith that reaches up is a faith that is single-hearted. I don't know if that is a correct expression. My wife tells me she's never heard it before. Is it single-minded? Anyone heard single-hearted? No? Okay, so that's just me. Single-minded, if you prefer. A faith that is single-minded and a faith that expects God to move in power. So the first one then, faith that is single-hearted. Let's look at these words. This was just before the sacrifice. So Ahab sent word throughout all Israel and assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. Elijah went before the people and said, how long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him. But the people said nothing. How long will you waver between two opinions? These were people who had no problem worshipping two gods at the same time. It's absolutely not a problem for them. They were well able to worship Yahweh during times of military struggle. He was the God who'd rescued them from the Egyptians. Let's pray to him for success in battle. But then when it came to times when they needed fertility in their families or in amongst their animals or in their crops, then they'd pray to Baal because he was the God of fertility. No problems. Wavering. Where shall I put the majority of my devotion? It's odd that they kept worshipping Baal, given that they hadn't had rain, but maybe they thought the worst thing they can do in a drought is to abandon Baal. Maybe they thought he was their one hope of success, I don't know. But they wavered in their situation because they had options. Yeah, they had options. And we, too, have religious options. I don't know how many Baal worshippers there are in this country. I don't know what the national census would tell us. I remember a number of years ago there was a sort of an internet thing and everyone, lots of people put themselves down as followers of the Jedi Force. But not many Baal worshippers probably, but we have people of every description in our country and in our city. We live, don't we, in a pluralistic climate of faith. We live in a marketplace of faith. There are many different things that people perhaps feel they can choose. And so the conclusion many draw today is the content of your faith isn't what matters, it's the sincerity of your faith. That's the litmus test of a truly religious person. Are they sincere? I'll tell you, the prophets of Baal were sincere. They were sincere enough to cut themselves and bleed. But people would say today, sincerity is the key, not the content of your belief. And of course, some would say that, you know, we're really the different religions are like those different routes up the mountain, and you know, the Christians are taking one route and the Muslims another and the Hindus another. And won't we all be surprised when we get to the top and realize we'd all been worshipping the same God all along, albeit just giving him different names. So there is that sort of view out there, but that is a million miles away from what we see in 1 Kings 18 with Elijah. Elijah's not really into political correctness, it has to be said. He says it very simply. If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him. If the God we follow is God, follow him. If he's not, let's not follow him. Yeah? Simple as that. He goes on, of course, to prove who is God. Now, we live with these religions around us, and it's vital, absolutely vital, we respect people of other religions. It's vital we fight for their religious freedom, I believe. The Baptists were the ones who led the fight for religious tolerance 400 years ago at a time when they weren't tolerated in this country. Some were put into prison and so on because of their views, their Baptist views. We do believe in defending religious freedom, don't we? And I think that's a principle. God has given us a degree of freedom. But those things are very different to saying, I agree with what you believe. You know, the Bible is uncompromising in its presentation of God to us. Look at what Jesus said. He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. There's one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. You know, if Jesus is who he said he was, then we have to assume that people who do not follow him cannot be satisfied spiritually, don't we? Shouldn't we start from that position? If Jesus is the living water who refreshes our soul, if he is the bread of life, if he is the only way to the Father, his death on the cross, then we should expect that those around who are not following him will not be satisfied. They may feel satisfied, and you know, we're not going to tell them something in their face. If they feel that, that's fine. But actually, our confidence, if who Jesus said is true, is that they can't be satisfied deep down, fundamentally. They can't be right with God if they haven't got Jesus. So let's not waver in our understanding of the uniqueness of Jesus. He is God. But I think for us, perhaps, our problem as Christians is that we too often worship two gods. You might say, well, I don't. I worship God, the Father of Jesus, and so on. But I think we all have this idolatry problem, don't we? There are areas of our life, or there are times of our life, when we're happy to follow God wholeheartedly. But then there are other areas where we follow a God that goes by a different name. Those idols in our life, whatever they might be, you know, that idol perhaps of materialism and acquisition, the idol of sex or alcohol, the idol of individualism and self, whatever they might be, we can all as Christians be tempted to waver. I'll give God this much of my time and commitment, but actually this bit I'm following this other God. So we need to watch out for that. The message we get from today, I think, is that these idols will always disappoint. They do not give what they promise to give. They will let you down. They will leave you in spiritual drought. Ultimately, only God is real. Only God can satisfy. There is another way we waver as Christians, and that is sometimes we waver in the strength of our belief, don't we? I don't know if what the strength of your belief is like. I think at times, sometimes our belief in God is not what it should be. It's weaker. Problem, of course, is if we only have a little bit of belief, it may lead to just a little bit of commitment. Yeah. There was a time in my life, it was about 20 years ago, I think, more or less, where I was a Christian, in fact, I was a Christian worker. But I started to see some attraction to agnosticism. Now, I'm not saying I wanted to become an agnostic, but I was sort of drawn to it a little bit because I thought, well, God hasn't categorically proved his existence. We can't prove that. Sorry, we can't prove that. We can't categorically prove that God doesn't exist. So perhaps then the way to go is agnosticism, this idea, well, I'm not going to quite decide because I'm not sure. I can't prove it either way. And I thought this might have something to commend it for a while. The problem for me is that shortly after that, God did reveal himself in what felt to me an utterly categorical way. And do you know my first thought? I thought, oh dear, this means I have to be committed. I had no excuse anymore for my half-heartedness. I was so overwhelmingly convinced of the reality of God that I thought, wow, that is too much reality to live with. Because that has to change my life. You know, I'm not saying you hide behind agnosticism or I was doing that then. But sometimes, you know, we need that strength of belief that says boldly, God, I believe in you. I believe in you. I'm going to live. I'm going to sit on the fence my whole life and say, well, I'm not sure. Or it's 50-50. I'm going to believe in you, God. And as I said, I don't think we can categorically prove God's existence. If we could, we would have done that already. But there is overwhelming evidence for God in our world. And that's a whole other sermon. Sorry, guys, can you just stop talking, would you, please? It's distracting me, and thank you. Sorry. So, we can waver. How long will you waver between two opinions? Have you got a faith that is bold? Of course, the other way we may waver is because we're not quite at that point of saying Jesus is Lord. Some of us may not call ourselves Christians yet. And as someone said, what happened at 3 o'clock? And they say, well, it's when Jesus was crucified. And that's absolutely true. You know, we have that sacrifice on Mount Carmel. And then less than 1,000 years later, we have that other sacrifice on Mount Calvary at the same time of the day. And Jesus was on the cross and he cried out, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. People thought he was calling for Elijah, this powerful prophet, to come and help him because he's in trouble on the cross. But they misunderstood because the cross wasn't a failure or a weakness. It was an acceptable sacrifice to God of the Lamb of God. And that is where Jesus triumphed over his enemies. That is where Jesus made that statement once and for all. Here is the true God. The gods of the world are idols. Here is where salvation is to be found. And you remember that centurion at the foot of the cross. He looked up at Jesus and said, truly, this man was the Son of God. So we may waver in a number of different ways. Let's not waver. And then we have, secondly, we should have a faith that expects God to move in power. Do you have Elijah's faith? Probably not. We sing, these are the days of Elijah. But I wonder if we see God work in powerful ways. You know, there are two amazing miracles in this chapter. The first one is that Elijah prays for the fire and the fire falls. And the second one is that Elijah, at the end of the chapter, prays for rain. And in answer to that prayer, God sends the rain and ends the drought. Amazing miracles here. God says, I am the sovereign God, sovereign over all creation. Now you might say, well, that's okay, that's Elijah. He's one of those radical prophets, you know. John the Baptist was a type of Elijah, wasn't it? Lived in the desert, you know, and they dressed kind of weirdly. And we're told Elijah wore this very uncomfortable clothing. And, you know, very different to us. But actually, the New Testament says the opposite to that. It says in James 5, the prayer of a righteous man is powerful and effective. Elijah was a man just like us. He prayed earnestly that it wouldn't rain, and it didn't rain on the land for 3.5 years. Again, he prayed, and the heavens gave rain, and the earth produced its crops. Just like us. Don't know if you remember me talking about spiritual gifts. It was actually 2 years ago, this particular talk. But I divided the gifts between power gifts, love gifts, and word gifts. Does that ring a bell? And talk about love gifts, and gifts like mercy and giving and the gift of helps, yeah? And then we thought about word gifts, things like teaching and prophecy and wisdom and knowledge and those things. And then power gifts, like miracles and faith and power and so on, healing. It's not a biblical division, but it's quite helpful in some ways. And we considered how sometimes in churches you may see some that really focus on the power gifts, and they're always looking for that. Some focus on the word gifts, what you call teaching churches, I guess. But sometimes that may come at the expense of some of the other gifts. Some are really into the love gifts. They're known for their service, but not so good on the teaching or expecting the power. And this is my understanding of HBC. I mean, you may disagree with this. I think we're good at the love gifts. Lots of service going on here. I think we're good at the word gifts. But I think we're not quite so good at the power gifts. I don't think, are quite as balanced as we think we are. And I don't think we should be content. I think we should expect God to move at times in powerful ways. God hasn't weakened with time. He hasn't decided in the 21st century not to use his power. He is the same God who sent his fire on that day, on that mountain. Where would God send his power in history? Where did God send his fire in the New Testament? Pentecost. That's where the fire is today, isn't it? Well, that's true. There was the fire in the burning bush with Moses in the Old Testament. That's right, Rachel. That's right. And in the New Testament, the fire fell on the church, not on a dead animal sacrifice. God demonstrates his power now through the church. His spirit fell on the 120, and the room was shaken, and there was something that appeared to be tongues of fire on their heads. That is the business God is in. That is God's aim. His aim is to send his power on us as a demonstration to the people around us who God is. That people may say, as they did in Elijah's day, the Lord, he is God. I'm going to repeat that illustration I've used about Harry Ironside, that evangelist and Bible teacher in San Francisco who was speaking in the open air, was preaching the gospel, and there was a man at the back who passed a card to him through the crowd, and he recognized the man. He was a leading socialist of the day. And he read the card, and this is what it said. It said, "Sir, I challenge you to debate with me the question, agnosticism versus Christianity, in the Academy of Science next Sunday afternoon at 4 p.m. I will pay all expenses." And Ironside addressed him, and he said, "I will accept your invitation, but on these terms. First of all, bring with you a man who was formerly a drunkard, and bring with you a woman who was formerly a prostitute." He said, "Bring these two people who have now turned from their ways because their lives have been turned around by the power of the message of agnosticism. Bring those people, and I will bring with me to the Academy of Science 100 people whose lives have been utterly transformed by the gospel. And then we can have our debate." And of course, the man declined. He declined the invitation because there was no power in agnosticism. The power today is in the gospel, and it is poured into the church. That is God's heart for us. That is his desire for us, that we show him to the world. I wonder if we could just be in a posture of prayer for a moment. Let's just close our eyes. Elijah wasn't just a man of words. He was a man of action. He was a man who prayed and things happened. We're told Elijah was just like us. I wonder if we're just like him. I think the place we need to start is as he started on Mount Carmel with rebuilding the altar. I wonder how you describe the altar to God in your life. On Mount Carmel it was in ruins because worship hadn't been taking place there. I wonder what that altar's like. And I believe that God would ask us, tell us for our own sake, if for no other reason, than to rebuild it, that we might be wholeheartedly devoted to him, that we might turn from our sin, that we might hunger for more of him. I'm sure many of us need to rebuild it. We're going to sing in a moment. There must be more than this. Sometimes as Christians we say there must be more than this, and it's actually, it's not God's deficiency sometimes, or most times it's our deficiency. There must be more than this. Spirit of God, we wait for you. Fill us anew, we pray. Consuming fire, fan into flame a passion for your name. Spirit of God, fall in this place. Lord, have your way. Lord, have your way with us. We're going to stand to sing this if we could, if you're able. If you want to respond by coming up to the front, you can do that. You don't have to, but if you want to say, I really want to rebuild that altar in my life so that God's power might be more evident in me, then do come to the front if you want. And when we've sung, I'm going to pray. I'll pray first of all from the front here for any who have come forwards, and then I'll pray for all of us, because I'm sure we all need to respond in some way to God this morning. So let's stand, shall we, and sing Consuming Fire. There must be more than this.